And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure back with our Monday afternoon book reading. I apologise, it was 2 weeks that I was away. And unfortunately, a similar thing's going to happen next Monday. But after that, I hope to be back on air fairly much uninterrupted over the November, December, October period. I do apologise, it sort of disjoints the book readings a little bit. But you'll remember we've been reading Ivanhoe. And we're getting very close to the end of the book, and we are at the point where Æthelstane, who was supposed to be dead, is not dead, but boy, has he got it in for the monks who tried to make out that he was, and in fact ensure that he was, because they stood to inherit a fair bit of land and gold as a result of his passing. But he's very much alive. Before we go to that, though, a word from the people who make our radio station possible.
Braidwood Community Bank, your local community bank supporting your local community. For friendly, helpful advice on general banking, investments, home loans, personal loans, retirement and superannuation and insurance, contact Braidwood Community Bank on 4842 1700, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Damn starter motor! I think it's finally given in. I'm miles from anywhere. What now?
Hallelujah.
That's right. Brendan and his team at Braidwood Auto Electrics have a fast mobile and on-site service. And I saved his number in my phone for that reason. Yeah, it's 4842 1008. Hi Brendan, it's Steve here. Yeah mate, that's starter motor. What? You can be here in 20 minutes? Great. See you then. Braidwood Auto Electrics. There for all your electrical needs. And he's a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood FM sponsor Real Tozer of Palak is your locally owned and operated chartered accountant in Bungendore and Braidwood. Real specialises in small business and primary production and can help you with the preparation of tax returns, activity statements, financial statements and your self-managed superannuation fund. She also provides bookkeeping services at bookkeeping prices. Find Real on Facebook or give her a call on 6164 2008.
Goulburn Workers Club is located in the heart of Goulburn CBD. There are three public bars, including a cocktail lounge boasting 20 different products on tap across the club, as well as full TAB and keno facilities. Enjoy Monday to Friday lunch specials for $10. Monday and Tuesday nights is half price steak or salmon. Wednesday nights is two roasts for the price of one. Thursday nights is $10 chicken schnitzel, and coffee and cake deals are available 7 days a week in the cafe. Goulburn Workers Club are proud to be a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors who, as I often say, help to make our radio station all that it can be. We need that local support. Well, continuing on with Ivanhoe and Æthelstane, who is very unhappy. "Talk not of delivering anyone," said Æthelstane. "It is well I am delivered myself. I am more intent on punishing that villain abbot. He shall hang on the top of this castle of Königsberg in his cope and stole, and if the stairs are too straight to admit his fat carcass, I will have him craned up from without."
"But my son," said Edith, "consider his sacred office."
"Consider my 3 days fast," replied Æthelstane. "I will have their blood, every one of them. Front de Boeuf was burnt alive for lesser matter, for he kept a good table for his prisoners. I only put too much garlic in his last dish of pottage. But these hypocritical, ungrateful slaves, so often the self-invited flatterers at my board, who gave me neither pottage nor garlic, more or less, they die. By the soul of Hengist, they die."
"But the Pope, my noble friend," said Cedric.
"But the devil, my noble friend," answered Æthelstane. "They die, and no more of them. Were they the best monks upon earth, the world would go on without them."
"For shame, noble Æthelstane," said Cedric. "Forget such wretches in the career of glory which lies open before you. Tell this Norman prince, Richard of Anjou, that the lion-hearted as he is, he shall not hold undisputed the throne of Alfred, while a male descendant of the Holy Confessor lives to dispute it."
"How?" said Æthelstane.
Is this the noble King Richard? It is Richard Plantagenet himself, said Cedric. Yet I need not remind you that coming here, a guest of free will, he may neither be injured nor detained prisoner. You well know your duty to him as his host. Ay, by my faith, said Athelstane, and my duty as a subject besides, for here I tender him my allegiance, heart and hand.
My son, said Edith, think on your royal rights.
Think on the freedom of England, degenerate prince, said Cedric.
Mother and friend, said Athelstane,
a truce to your upbraidings, bread and water and a dungeon are marvellous mortifiers of ambition, and I rise from the tomb a wiser man than I descended into it. One half of those vain follies were puffed into my ear by that perfidious Abbot Wolfram, and you may now judge if he is a counsellor to be trusted. Since these plots were set in agitation, I have had nothing but hurried journeys, indigestions, blows, bruises, imprisonments, starvation, besides what they can only end in the murder of some thousands of quiet folk. I tell you, I will be king in my own domains and nowhere else, and my first act of dominion will be to hang that abbot.
And my ward Rowena, said Cedric, I trust you intend not to desert her.
Father Cedric, said Athelstane, be reasonable. The Lady Rowena cares not for me. She loves the little finger of my kinsman Wilfred's glove better than my whole person. There she stands to avouch it. Nay, blush not, kinswoman. There is no shame in loving a courtly knight better than a country franklin. And do not laugh neither, Rowena, for grave clothes and a thin visage are, God knows, no matter of merriment. No, and you will needs laugh. I will find you a better jest. Give me your hand, or rather lend it to me, but I but ask for it in the way of friendship. Here, cousin, Wilfred of Ivanhoe, in your favour I renounce and abjure. Hey, by St. Dunstan, our cousin Wilfred has vanished. Yet unless my eyes are still dazzled with the fasting I have undergone, I saw him stand there but now. All looked around and inquired for Ivanhoe, but he had vanished. It was at length discovered that a Jew had been to seek him, and that after a very brief conference he had called for Garth and his armour, and had left the castle.
"Fair cousin," said Athelstane to Rowena, "could I think that this sudden disappearance of Ivanhoe was occasioned by other than the weightiest reason, I would myself resume—" But no sooner had he let go her hand, on first observing that Ivanhoe had disappeared, than Rowena, who had found her situation extremely embarrassing, had taken the first opportunity to escape from the apartment.
"Certainly," said Athelstane, "women are the least to be trusted of all animals, monks and abbots excepted. I am an infidel, if I expected not thanks from her, and perhaps a kiss to boot. Ah, these cursed grave clothes have surely a spell on them. Every one flies from me. To you I turn, noble King Richard, with the vows of allegiance, which, as a liege subject—"
But Richard was gone also, and no one knew where. At length it was learned that he had hastened to the courtyard, summoned to his presence by the Jew who had spoken with Ivanhoe, and after a moment's speech with him, had called vehemently to horse, thrown himself upon a steed, compelled the Jew to mount another, and set off at a rate which, according to Womba, rendered the old Jew's neck not worth a penny's purchase.
"By my halidome," said Athelstane, "it is certain that Zernebock hath possessed himself of my castle in my absence. I return in my grave clothes, a pledge restored from the very sepulchre, and every one I speak to vanishes as soon as they hear my voice. Ah, but it skills not talking off. Come, my friends, such of you as are left, follow me to the banquet hall, lest any more of us disappear. It is, I trust, as yet tolerably furnished, as becomes the obsequies of an ancient Saxon noble. And should we tarry any longer, who knows? The devil may fly off with supper."
Chapter 43. Our scene now returns to the exterior of the castle or preceptory of Templestowe, about the hour when the bloody die was to be cast for the life or death of Rebecca. It was a scene of bustle and life, as if the whole vicinity had poured forth its inhabitants to a village wake or a rural feast. But the earnest desire to look on blood and death is not peculiar to those dark ages, though in the gladiatorial exercise of single combat and general tourney they were habituated to the bloody spectacle of brave men falling by each other's hands. Even in our own days, when morals are better understood, an execution, a bruising match, a riot, or a meeting of radical reformers collects at considerable hazard to themselves immense crowds of spectators, otherwise little interested, except to see how matters are to be conducted, or whether the heroes of the day are, in the heroic language of insurgent tailors, flints or dunghills. The eyes, therefore, of a very considerable multitude were bent on the gate of the preceptory of Templestowe, with the purpose of witnessing the procession, while still greater numbers had already surrounded the tiltyard belonging to that establishment. This enclosure was formed on a piece of level ground, adjoining to the preceptory, which had been levelled with care for the exercise of military and chivalrous sports. It occupied the brow of a soft and gentle eminence, was carefully palisaded around, and as the Templars willingly invited spectators to be witnesses of their skill in feats of chivalry, was amply supplied with galleries and benches for their use. On the present occasion, a throne was erected for the Grand Master at the east end, surrounded with seats of distinction for the preceptors and knights of the order. Over these floated the sacred standard called Le Bourseillon, which was the ensign, as its name was the battle cry of the Templars. At the opposite end of the list was a pile of faggots, so arranged around a stake, deeply fixed in the ground, as to leave a space for the victim, whom they were destined to consume, to enter within the fatal circle, in order to be chained to the stake by fetters, which hung ready for the purpose. Beside this deadly apparatus stood four black slaves, whose colour and African features were so little known in England, appalled the multitude who gazed on them as demons employed about their own diabolical exercises. These men stirred not, excepting now and then, under the direction of one who seemed their chief, to shift and replace the ready fuel. They looked not on the multitude, in fact, they seemed insensible of their presence, and of everything save the discharge of their horrible duty. And when in speech with each other, they expanded their blubber lips and showed their white fangs, as if they grinned at the thoughts of the expected tragedy. The startled commons could scarcely help believing that they were actually the familiar spirits with whom the witch had communed, and who, her time being out, stood ready to assist in her dreadful punishment. They whispered to each other, and communicated all the feats which Satan had performed during that busy and unhappy period, not failing, of course, to give the devil rather more than his due. "Have you not heard, Father Dennett," quoted one bore to another of advanced years, "that the devil was carried away bodily, has carried away bodily the great Saxon thane, Athelstane of Konigsberg?" "Aye, but he brought him back, though, by the blessing of God and St. Dunstan." "How's that?" said a brisk young fellow, dressed in a green cassock, embroidered with gold and having at his heels a stout lad bearing a harp upon his back, which betrayed his vocation. The minstrel seemed of no vulgar rank, for besides the splendour of his gaily embroidered doublet, he wore round his neck a silver chain by which hung the rest or key with which he tuned his harp. On his right arm was a silver plate, which instead of bearing, as usual, the cognizance or badge of the baron to whose family he belonged, had barely the word Sherwood engraved upon it. "How mean you by that?" said the gay minstrel, mingling in the conversation of the peasants. "I came to seek one subject for my rhyme, and, by a lady, I were glad to find two." "It is well avouched," said the elder peasant, "that after Athelstane of Konigsberg had been dead 4 weeks." "That is impossible," said the minstrel. "I saw him in life at the passage of arms at Ashby de la Lue." "Dead, however, he was, or else translated," said the younger peasant, "for I heard the monks of St. Edmund singing the death's hymn for him, and moreover there was a rich death meal and dole at the castle of Konigsberg, as right was, and thither had I gone but for Mabel Parkins, who—" "Aye, dead was Athelstane," said the old man, shaking his head, "and the more pity it was for the old Saxon blood." "But your story, my masters, your story," said the minstrel somewhat impatiently. "Oi, oi, construe us the story," said a burly friar who stood beside them, leaning on a pole that exhibited an appearance between a pilgrim's staff and a quarter-staff, and probably acted as either when the occasion served. "Your story," said the stalwart churchman. "Burn not daylight about it. We have short time to spare." "And please your reverence," said Dennett, "a drunken priest came to visit the sacristan at St. Edmund's." "It does not please my reverence," answered the churchman, "that there should be such an animal as a drunken priest.
or if there were that a layman should so speak him. Be mannerly, my friend, and conclude the holy man, only wrapped in meditation, which makes the head dizzy and the foot unsteady, as if the stomach were filled with new wine. I have felt it myself.
Well, then, answered Father Dennett, a holy brother came to visit the sacristan at St. Edmund's. A sort of hedge priest is the visitor. He kills half the deer that are stolen in the forest, who loves the tinkling of a pint-pot better than a sacring bell, and deems a flitch of bacon worth 10 of his breviary. For the rest, a good fellow and a merry who will flourish a quarter-staff, draw a bow and dance a Cheshire round, with e'er a man in Yorkshire.
That last part of thy speech, Dennett, said the minstrel, has saved you a rib or two.
Oh, tush, man, I fear him not. I am somewhat old and stiff, but when I fought for the bell and ram at Doncaster...
But the story, my friend.
Why, the tale is but this. Æthelstane of Königsberg was buried at St. Edmund's.
That's a lie, said the friar, and a loud one, for I saw him borne to his own castle of Königsberg.
Nay, then, e'en tell the story yourself, my masters, said Dennett, turning sulky at these repeated contradictions,
and it was with some difficulty that the boar could be prevailed on, by the request of his comrade and the minstrel, to renew his tale.
These two sober friars, said he at length, since this reverend man will needs have them such, had continued drinking good ale and wine and what not for the best part of a summer's day, when they were aroused by a deep groan and a clanking of chains, and the figure of the deceased Æthelstane entered the apartment, saying, "Ye evil shepherds!"
"Oh, it is false," said the friar hastily. "He never spoke a word."
"So, Friar Tuck," said the minstrel, drawing him apart from the rustics, "we have started a new hare, I find."
"I tell thee, Allan a Dale," said the hermit, "I saw Æthelstane of Königsberg as much as bodily eyes ever saw a living man. He had his shroud on, and all about him smelt of the sepulchre. A butt of sack will not wash it from my memory."
"Pshaw," answered the minstrel, you jest with me."
"Never, believe me," said the friar. "I am fetched not a knock at him with my quarter-staff that would have felled an ox, and it glided through his body as it might through a pillar of smoke."
"By St. Hubert," said the minstrel, "but it is a wondrous tale, and fit to be put in the metre of the ancient tune. Sorrow came to the old friar."
"Oh, laugh if you wish," said Friar Tuck, "but you catch me singing on such a theme, may the next ghost or devil carry me off with him headlong. No, no, no. I instantly formed the purpose of assisting at some good work, such as burning of a witch, a judicial combat, or the like matter of godly services, and therefore am I here." As they thus conversed, the heavy bell of the Church of St. Michael of Templestowe, a venerable building situated in a hamlet at some distance from the preceptory, broke short their argument. One by one the sullen sounds fell successively on the ear, leaving but sufficient space for each to die away in a distant echo, ere the ear was again filled by repetition of the iron knell. These sounds, the signal of the approaching ceremony, chilled with awe the hearts of the assembled multitude, whose eyes were now turned to the preceptory, expecting the approach of the Grand Master, the champion, and the criminal. At length the drawbridge fell. The gates opened, and a knight bearing the great standard of the order sallied from the castle, preceded by six trumpets and followed by the knight's preceptors, two and two, the Grand Master coming last, mounted on a stately horse whose furniture was of the simplest kind. Behind him came Brian de Bois-Guilbert, armed cap-a-pie in bright armour, but without his lance, shield and sword, which were borne by his two esquires behind him. His face, though partly hidden by a long plume which floated down from his beret cap, bore a strong and mingled expression of passion in which pride seemed to contend with irresolution. He looked ghastly pale, as if he had not slept for several nights, yet reined his pawing war horse with the habitual ease and grace proper to the best lance of the Order of the Temple. His general appearance was grand and commanding, but looking at him with attention, men read that in his dark features, from which they willingly withdrew their eyes.
On the other side rode Conrad of Montfichet and Albert de Malvoisin, who acted as godfathers to the champion. They were in their robes of peace, the white dress of the order. Behind them followed other companions of the temple, with a long train of esquires and pages, clad in black, aspirants to the honour of being one day knights of the order. After these neophytes came a guard of warders on foot, in the same sable livery, amidst whose partisans might be seen the pale form of the accused, moving with a slow but undismayed step towards the scene of her fate. She was stripped of all her ornaments, lest perchance there should be among them some of those amulets which Satan was supposed to bestow upon his victims to deprive them of the power of confession, even when under the torture. A coarse white dress of the simplest form had been substituted for her oriental garments, yet there was such an exquisite mixture of courage and resignation in her look that even in this garb, and with no other ornament than her long black tresses, each eye wept that looked upon her, and the most hardened bigot regretted the fate that had converted a creature so goodly into a vessel of wrath and a waged slave of the devil. A crowd of inferior personages belonging to the preceptory followed the victim, all moving with the utmost order, with arms folded and looks bent upon the ground. This slow procession moved up the gentle eminence, on the summit of which was the tilt-yard, and entering the lists, marched once around them from right to left, and when they had completed the circle, made a halt. There was then a momentary bustle, while the Grand Master and all his attendants, excepting the champion and his godfathers, dismounted from their horses, which were immediately removed out of the lists by the squires who were in attendance for that purpose. The unfortunate Rebecca was conducted to the black chair placed near the pile. On her first glance at the terrible spot, where preparations were making for a death alike dismaying to the mind and painful to the body, she was observed to shudder and shut her eyes, praying internally, doubtless, for her lips moved, though no speech was heard. In the space of a minute she opened her eyes, looked fixedly on the pile, as if to familiarise her mind with the object, and then slowly and naturally turned away her head. Meanwhile, the Grand Master had assumed his seat, and when the chivalry of his order was placed around and behind him, each in his due rank, a loud and long flourish of the trumpets announced that the court was seated for judgment. Malvoisin, then acting as godfather of the champion, stepped forward and laid the glove of the Jewess, which was the pledge of battle, at the feet of the Grand Master. "Valorous Lord and Reverend Father," said he, "here standeth the good knight Brian de Bois-Guilbert, knight preceptor of the Order of the Temple, who by accepting the pledge of battle which I now lay at your reverence's feet, has become bound to do his best in combat this day, to maintain that this Jewish maiden, by name Rebecca, has justly deserved the doom passed upon her in a chapter of this most holy order of the Temple of Zion, condemning her to die as a sorceress. Here I say he stands, such battle to do, knightly and honourable, if such be your noble and sanctified pleasure." "Hath he made oath," said the Grand Master, "that his quarrel is just and honourable? Bring forward the crucifix and the tiegateur." Most reverend father," answered Malvoisin readily, "our brother here present has already sworn to the truth of his accusation in the hand of the good knight Conrad de Montfichet, and otherwise he ought not to be sworn, seeing that his adversary is an unbeliever and may take no oath." This explanation was satisfactory to Albert's great joy, for the wily knight had foreseen the great difficulty, or rather impossibility, of prevailing upon Brian de Bois-Guilbert to take such an oath before the assembly, and had invented this excuse to escape the necessity of his doing so. The Grand Master, having allowed the apology of Albert Malvoisin, commanded the herald to stand forth and do his best. The trumpets then again flourished, and a herald stepped forward, proclaiming aloud, "Oyez, oyez, oyez! Here stands the good knight Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert, ready to do battle with any knight of free blood, who will sustain the quarrel allowed and allotted to the Jewess Rebecca, to try by champion in respect of lawful essoir of her own body, and to such champion the reverend and valorous Grand Master here present allows a fair field and equal partition of sun and wind, and whatever else appertains to a fair combat. The trumpets then again sounded, and there was a dead pause of many minutes.
"No champion appears for the appellant," said the Grand Master. "Go, Herald, and ask her whether she expects anyone to do battle for her in this her cause."
The Herald went to the chair in which Rebecca was seated, and Bois Guilbert, suddenly turning his horse's head toward that end of the lists, in spite of hints on either side from Malvoisin and Montfichet, was by the side of Rebecca's chair as soon as the Herald.
"Is this regular and according to the law of combat?" said Malvoisin, looking to the Grand Master.
"Albert de Malvoisin it is," answered de Beaumonnet, "for in this appeal to the judgment of God, we may not prohibit parties from having that communication with each other which may best tend to bring forth the truth of the quarrel."
In the meantime, the Herald spoke to Rebecca in these terms.
"Damsel, the Honourable and Reverend and the Grand Master demands of you, if you are prepared with a champion, to do battle this day on your behalf, or if you do yield as one justly condemned to a deserved doom."
"Say to the Grand Master," replied Rebecca, "that I maintain my innocence, and do not yield me as justly condemned, lest I become guilty of mine own blood. Say to him that I challenge such delay as his forms will permit, to see if God, whose opportunity is in man's extremity, will raise me up a deliverer, and when such uttermost space is past, may his holy will be done." The Herald retired to carry this answer to the Grand Master.
"God forbid," said Lucas Beaumonnard, "that Jew or pagan should impeach us of injustice. Until the shadows be cast from the west to the eastward, will we wait to see if a champion shall appear for this unfortunate woman. When the day is so far past, let her prepare for death."
The Herald communicated the words of the Grand Master to Rebecca, who bowed her head submissively, folded her arms, and looking up towards heaven, seemed to expect that aid and from above, which she could scarce promise herself from man. During this awful pause, the voice of Bois Guilbert broke upon her ear. It was but a whisper, yet it startled her more than the summons of the Herald had appeared to.
"Rebecca," said the Templar, "do you hear me?"
"I have no portion in thee, cruel-hearted man," said the unfortunate maiden.
"Yes, but do you understand my words?" said the Templar. "For the sound of my voice is frightful to my own ears. I scarce know on what ground we stand, or for what purpose they have brought us here, this listed space, that chair, these faggots. I know their purpose, and yet it appears to me like something unreal. The fearful picture of a vision which appalls my senses with hideous fantasies, but convinces not my reason."
"My mind and my senses keep touch and time," answered Rebecca, "and tell me alike that these faggots are destined to consume my earthly body and open a painful but a brief passage to a better world."
"Dreams, Rebecca, dreams," answered the Templar. "Idle visions rejected by the wisdom of your own wiser Sadducees. Hear me, Rebecca," he said, proceeding with animation. "A better chance has you for life and liberty than yonder knaves and dotard dream of. Mount you behind me on my steed, on Zamor, the gallant horse that never failed his rider. I won him in a single fight from the Soldan of Trebizond. Mount, I say, behind me. In one short hour is pursuit and inquiry far behind. A new world of pleasure opens to you, to me a new career of fame. Let them speak the doom which I despise and erase the name of Bois Guilbert from their list of monastic slaves. I will wash out with blood whatever blot they may dare to cast on my scutcheon." "Tempter," said Rebecca, "be gone. Not in this last extremity can you move me one hair's breadth from my resting place, surrounded as I am by foes. I hold you as my worst and most deadly enemy. Avoid you in the name of God."
Albert Malvoisin, alarmed and impatient at the duration of their conference, now advanced to interrupt it. "Has the maiden acknowledged her guilt?" he demanded of Bois Guilbert, "or is she resolute in her denial?"
"She is indeed resolute," said Bois Guilbert.
"Then," said Malvoisin, "must you, noble brother, resume your place to attend the issue. The shades are changing on the circle of the dial. Come, brave Bois Guilbert, come, you hope of our holy order, and soon to be its head."
As he spoke in this soothing tone, he laid his hand on the knight's bridle, as if to lead him back to his station.
"False villain! What mean you by your hand on my rein?" said Sir Brian angrily, and shaking off his companion's grasp, he rode back to the upper end of the lists.
"There is yet spirit in him," said Malvoisin apart to Montfichet. "Were it well directed, but, like the Greek fire, it burns whatever approaches it." The judges had now been 2 hours in the lists, awaiting in vain the appearance of a champion.
"And reason good," said Friar Tuck, "seeing she is a Jewess, and yet, by my order, it is hard that so young and beautiful a creature should perish without a blow being struck on her behalf. Were she 10 times a witch, provided she were but the least bit of Christian, my quarterstaff should ring noon on the steel cap of yonder fierce Templar ere he carried the matter off."
It was, however, the general belief that no one could, or indeed would, appear for a Jewess accused of sorcery, and the knights, instigated by Malvoisin, whispered to each other that it was time to declare the pledge of Rebecca forfeited. At this instant a knight, urging his horse to speed, appeared on the plain advancing towards the lists. 100 voices exclaimed, "A champion! A champion!" And despite the prepossessions and prejudices of the multitude, they shouted unanimously as the knight rode into the tilt-yard. The second glance, however, served to destroy the hope that his timely arrival had excited. His horse, urged for many miles to its utmost speed, appeared to reel from fatigue, and the rider, however undauntedly he presented himself in the lists, either from weakness, weariness, or both, seemed scarce able to support himself in the saddle. To the summons of the herald, who demanded his rank, his name, and purpose, the stranger knight answered readily and boldly, "I am a good knight and noble come hither to sustain with lance and sword the just and lawful quarrel of this damsel Rebecca, daughter of Isaac of York, to uphold the doom pronounced against her to be false and truthless, and to defy Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert as a traitor, a murderer, and a liar, as I will prove in this field with my body against his, by the aid of God, Our Lady, and of Monsignor St. George, the good knight."
"The stranger must first show," said Malvoisin, "that he is a good knight and of honourable lineage. The temple sends not forth her champions against nameless men."
"My name," said the knight, raising his helmet, "is better known, my lineage more pure, Malvoisin, than yours. I am Wilfred of Ivanhoe."
"I will not fight with thee at present," said the Templar in a changed and hollow voice. "Get your wounds healed. Get yourself a better horse, and it may be I will hold it worth my while to scourge out of you this boyish spirit of bravado."
"Ha! Proud Templar," said Ivanhoe. "Have you forgotten that twice you have fallen before this lance? Remember the lists at Acre. Remember the passage of arms at Ashby. Remember your proud vault in the halls of Rotherwood, and the gauge of your gold chain against my reliquary, that you would do battle with Wilfred of Ivanhoe and recover the honour you had lost. By that reliquary, and the holy relic it contains, I will proclaim you, Templar, a coward in every court in Europe, in every preceptory of your order, unless you do battle without further delay."
Bois-Guilbert turned his countenance irresolutely towards Rebecca, and then exclaimed, looking fiercely at Ivanhoe, "Dog of a Saxon! Take your lance and prepare for the death you have drawn upon yourself."
"Does the Grand Master allow me combat?" said Ivanhoe.
"I may not deny what you have challenged," said the Grand Master, "provided the maiden accept you as her champion. Yet I would you were in a better plight to do battle."
"An enemy of our order have you ever been, yet I would have you honourably met with."
"Thus I am, and not otherwise," said Ivanhoe. "It is the judgment of God. To his keeping I commend myself. Rebecca," said he, riding up to the fatal chair, "do you accept of me as your champion?"
I do," she said. I do," fluttered by an emotion which the fear of death had been unable to produce. I do accept you as the champion who heaven has sent to me. Yet your wounds are uncured. Meet not that proud man. Why should you perish too?"
But Ivanhoe was already at his post, and had closed his visor and assumed his lance. Bois Guilbert did the same, and his esquire remarked as he clasped his visor that his face, which had, notwithstanding the variety of emotions by which he had been agitated, continued during the whole morning of an ashy paleness, was now become suddenly very much flushed. The herald then, seeing each champion in his place, uplifted his voice, repeating thrice, "Faites-vos devoir, preux chevalier." After the third cry, he withdrew to one side of the lists and again proclaimed that none, on peril of instant death, should dare by word, cry, or action to interfere with or disturb this fair field of combat. The Grand Master, who held in his hand the gauge of battle, Rebecca's glove, now threw it into the lists and pronounced the fatal words, "Laissez aller!" The trumpets sounded and the knights charged each other in full career. The wearied horse of Ivanhoe and its no less exhausted rider went down, as all had expected, before the well-aimed lance and vigorous steed of the Templar. This issue of the combat all had foreseen, but although the spear of Ivanhoe did but, in comparison, touch the shield of Bois Guilbert, that champion, to the astonishment of all who beheld it, reeled in his saddle, lost his stirrups, and fell in the lists. Ivanhoe, extricating himself from his fallen horse, was soon on foot, hastening to mend his fortune with his sword, but his antagonist arose not. Wilfred, placing his foot on his breast and the sword's point to his throat, commanded him to yield or die. Bois Guilbert returned no answer. "Slay him not, Sir Knight," cried the Grand Master. "Unshriven and unabsolved, kill not body and soul. We allow him vanquished." He descended into the lists and commanded them to unhelm the conquered champion. His eyes were closed. The dark red flush was still on his brow. As they looked on him in astonishment, the eyes opened, but they were fixed and glazed. The flush passed from his brow and gave way to the pallid hue of death. Unscathed by the lance of his enemy, he had died, a victim to the violence of his own contending passions. "This is indeed the judgment of God," said the Grand Master, looking upwards. "Fiat voluntas tua." Well, de Bois Guilbert dies in the lists and Rebecca is saved. We have about 10 pages left to go. Anybody who has watched the film Ivanhoe would be as amazed as I have been to actually read the way in which Bois Guilbert died. No fantastic fight between, I think it was Basil Rathbone and Robert Taylor, fighting with axe and mace till one or the other are half beaten to death. No, he died a subject to his own passion, his own failure to come to terms with what he loved and what he didn't love. Quite fascinating. Well, as I said, I'll be missing for a week and we will finish Ivanhoe. I think next we will read something, well, as Monty Python would say, something completely different. I'm thinking perhaps of a master of horror who was totally ignored in his lifetime, lived in poverty. A man called Lovecraft, who gave rise to role-playing games in the modern era and is famous for stories about the Cthulhu. We might read one or two of his short stories. They're interesting, if only because they were written in the 1920s, and I'll have more to say about that when the time comes. I'll be back in a fortnight to finish Ivanhoe. Until then, Braidwood, keep well, keep safe, and keep warm.